From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Surviving the Planet X Tribulation. Marshall Masters joins us. Here's what's happening. In Hawaii, the lava lake at the summit of Kilauea Volcano has now been rising in recent days, offering visitors a dramatic view of rolling, spattering hot rock. The Hawaiian Volcano Observatory research scientist Don Swanson says scientists don't know exactly why the lava is this high. He said it's relatively unusual, though. The lava overflowed onto the crater floor in May of last year, raising the rim that confines the lake by another 30 feet. They're wondering, is it going to blow its top? And a magnitude 3.5 earthquake struck near San Francisco. That's not relatively big, but it could be a sign of something else. Cal Ori, of course, noted author, the man who predicts earthquakes, about the late Jim Berkland. Cal, 3.5, not that big, but what does that tell you?
It tells me that it was man-made. Get this. I found this in Contra Costa Times tonight. Last Friday night, geologists installed 500 portable seismographs along the Hayward and Chabot faults. By triggering their tiny explosions, the scientists hope to simulate earthquakes along the Hayward Fault to better study their patterns. They caused it.
No way.
A sharp jolt, it was shallow. When shallow quakes happen, more times than not, it's man messing around, like with the geysers, like they did here in Reno. We have a full moon on September 16th. What are they thinking?
Oh, my gosh. What if this could have been a 5 or a 6?
Well, the week isn't over.
No, that's true. Cal, do you still think California is headed for the big one?
No, I think I'm going down in Alaska next week, and you all miss me. Alaska first, California second. Alaska is the most shaky state. Berkland taught me that, Jim Berkland. Bless his heart.
Miss him already, don't you?
Huh?
You miss him already, don't
you? Oh, I'm still getting emails from people that don't even know. Yeah, it goes on and on. But he's with us. He was a really religious man. He's cool. But
all right.
Just to say your prayers for me for Alaska.
We will, and you keep in touch with us. So man-made 3.5 earthquake near San Francisco. The U.S. government is coming under fire from animal rights activists amid concerns that almost 45,000 wild horses could be euthanized in an attempt to control their numbers. Last week, the Bureau of Land Management's Natural Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Board, didn't even know they had one, recommended that the Bureau euthanize or sell off, without limitation, excess unadoptable horses and burros. Now, an unadoptable horse or burro is typically at least 5 years old, making them less attractive for purchase or adoption. The Bureau has more than 44,000 horses and 1,000 burros in off-range pastures and corrals. An Australian study has found that about 1 in 5 corporate executives are psychopaths, roughly the same rate as prisoners. Psychiatrist Dr. Peter Bregan with us. Peter, first of all, what's a psychopath exactly?
Well, people have a lot of different definitions for it. Somebody who doesn't feel guilt or shame the way other people do. Somebody who can stand back and manipulate people and not react. I do think, in fact, from my experience now, George, over 80 years of on this earth, that it's been my constant experience that the higher up people are in any system that I'm trying to work in or acquainted with, that the more they're just simply power-oriented. That's how they got to the top. They want power, they want wealth. And I don't think it's so much they lack guilt and shame, is that they have lied to themselves about how they're harming people, and they lack empathy for people they can't see in front of their nose. So when they're running a pharmaceutical company and hiding how much they're poisoning people, which is a routine phenomena, I think they're just so remote and so preoccupied with their own survival and their own success that they have no connection to the people they're harming. They're just not even in the equation. I've seen it in working with people in the major media who've come to film me about something, or
yeah.
when I get interviewed by the top newspaper people, that they have a kind of dumbness about how people are being hurt, and they're really attuned to how to keep their jobs.
Well, typically, psychopaths create, they say, a lot of chaos and generally tend to play people off against each other. Do you find that to be the case, Peter?
I think that's the unsuccessful ones who get in trouble.
Yeah.
I think that we're talking about people who actually have pretty smooth, good social skills, and they use them to get a lot of power and a lot of influence. We see it in politics. We know about Wall Street. The one place I don't see it so much, and I'm not pandering to you, George, is talk radio. From the earliest years of my public work, the most I've been able to find honest people is in the area of talk radio. Do you have that sense?
I hope so.
I think
I hope
true.
So. Thank you, Peter. Dr. Peter Regan, reacting to a study of 1 in 5 CEOs are psychopaths, according to an Australian study. What a story. Scandal-ridden Wells Fargo, the bank, just lost its crown as America's most valuable bank. Wells Fargo's stock dropped nearly 4% after the bank announced plans to abandon its sales targets, where customers were sold multiple bank products. Employees have said that these unrealistic targets led to a pressure cooker environment that prompted them to create millions of fake accounts. Wells Fargo recently fined $185 million and admitted to firing 5,300 employees related to the phony accounts. And the Wells Fargo executive who oversaw the unit that created the almost 2 million in unauthorized customer accounts is soon to retire from the company with, get this, a $125 million payday. That's the golden parachute as she walks out the door. $125 million. And Bank America analysts claim there's a 50% chance we live in a matrix reality simulation. The Bank of America's Merrill Lynch unit made the astonishing claim in a research note, citing comments by top scientists, astrophysics, and philosophers. SpaceX founder Elon Musk, by the way, is one of those who almost certainly believes our world is run by an artificial intelligence developed by a future civilization. So we're really not here. You believe that? And Jeff Bezos is joining the big boys of commercial spaceflight. As we've reported, his company Blue Origin announced that it has built a rocket called the New Glenn that is capable of putting payloads into orbit. Robert Zimmerman, our science advisor and space historian. This is exciting news, Robert.
Well, it is, George, but I have to correct you. They haven't built anything. They are proposing and they have announced the design for this rocket. It's a big one. It would be almost the size of a Saturn V. It's comparable to the Falcon Heavy that SpaceX got, but they don't have a launch. The earliest they'll launch is before the end of the decade, if they do what they say they're going to do. And we all know this is rocket science, so don't put your house savings on it, unless that alien matrix you're mentioning is really controlling things.
Uh-huh.
It's built quicker.
Well, you know, don't they even have a model of this thing
constructed? Oh, yeah. They've outlined what they want it to look like, and they've talked about how it'll be designed. But we're only talking right now computer design.
Right. It's not launch.
We're talking about actual cut metal. They haven't finished building the fundamental engine that this rocket needs. That engine isn't going to get its first static fire tests maybe until the spring. So we are. This is an announcement. What's interesting is he's named his first suborbital craft New Shepard after Alan Shepard, who did the first suborbital flight, and he's naming this New Glenn after John Glenn, who made the first American orbital flight. He has said that his next big achievement after they build a rocket that hasn't been built yet would be New Armstrong, and he went to the moon. So this tells you where Jeff Bezos wants to go.
All right, Robert, keep in touch. Love these space stories. 11 years ago, a young man passed away, and it changed his father in such a way that he decided to develop a foundation, something that could be used to help other people in a similar situation. We will explain next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Litigator, author, entrepreneur Robert Shapiro has been named by the New York Times as one of the nation's most prominent attorneys. He lives in Los Angeles. Mr. Shapiro heads the firm's white-collar criminal defense group. Now, his list of high-profile cases include, of course, the defense of O.J. Simpson, Christian Brando, Robert Evans, Steve Wynn. Mr. Shapiro's experience and expertise also includes international law, having successfully represented numerous high-profile clients all around the country and the world, including notable cases in China, Denmark, child custody cases related to the Hague Commission as well and the convention. He's a noted author. His one of his big books is called The Search for Justice. And here is Robert Shapiro on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you, George. Let me just correct one thing before Steve Wynn calls me. I not only do criminal cases, but I do mostly now civil litigation.
Civil, exactly.
And I'm representing Mr. Wynn and Wynn Resorts on a major civil case. So
that's what that not is. Every,
not everybody you mentioned would fall into the criminal category.
Well, you know, everybody that hears your name thinks of you as a criminal attorney exclusively, and you're right.
And you know, I've been trying to get away from that for the last 20 years, and most of my corporate clients realize that I am very effective on the civil side, but the public perception still is that, George.
Well, I guess there's nothing wrong with being called a high-profile lawyer, is there?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. But my practice has changed dramatically from the times when I really was an exclusive criminal defense lawyer to now being really a business lawyer and a civil litigator.
I know we don't talk about your past cases because, one, you don't do that. And we're not going to get any answers out of you anyway.
Well, you know what? You know what? People have tried. So, you know, you're welcome to take a shot. You're a friend of mine. I don't mind.
I'm going to ask you one question about the OJ situation. Not the trial that you defended. And you and the Dream Team did a great job. He was acquitted. But afterward, he gets nailed on kidnapping charges and stuff. And he's in jail for God knows how long. How bizarre.
You know, let me tell you the irony of that case. And I didn't follow it very closely. But in the civil case, after the Goldmans brought a lawsuit against him, they won a judgment of $33 million.
Mm-hmm.
In the criminal case in Las Vegas, what do you think his sentence was?
The criminal case in Las 33 years, wasn't it?
How what a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
$33 million forfeited.
Uh-huh.
33 years in jail.
Yeah. Parole after 9 years, which he's coming up on, I think, this year, right?
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. How's his health? Have you heard anything about
that? You know, I know less about him than probably most people. I mean, obviously, every once in a while, a picture of him shows up in the news, and he doesn't look too well.
No, he does not. You worked with Kardashian on that original defense, right?
Absolutely.
It is. Did you ever expect his family to take off in celebrity mode after that?
You know, I really didn't know his family well, and I didn't know Robert at all. When I was called by actually somebody who was in the entertainment business, by Roger King, whose family owned King World,
Wheel
of Fortune, Jeopardy,
yeah,
and
great
Oprah Winfrey. And he was close friends with Simpson, and he was the one who actually said, I'm going to hire you to represent him. And I said, don't you think Mr. Simpson should have something to say about that? And the next day I met with Simpson and became his lawyer.
Well, you all did your job and did it well, to be sure. But you're here to talk about something that has been so near and dear to you for a long time, 11 years now.
11 years since the passing of Brent in 2005.
I want you, for a lot of new people, Robert, who might not know this situation in this story, I'd like for you, as well as you can, because I don't want to dwell up any pain at all, but do tell us what happened.
George, first of all, when you talk about pain, it's very hard to articulate personal feelings when you lose anyone close to you. And when a parent loses a son or daughter, it's inexplicable. One of the things that you learn very quickly is that it never goes away.
No.
It could have been 10 years, 11 years ago, which it was. Could be 10 hours ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago.
40 years ago.
It's always the same. It's never going to leave you. So our story is one that unfortunately we're hearing now almost every 20 minutes in this country of people dying from alcohol and drugs. And in Brent's case, it was both. He was a alcoholic and a drug addict as a late teenager. We found out about it. And like most families, thought, well, you know, it's a phase. He's experimenting. Mm-hmm. That's what people do.
He'll grow out of it.
You know, et cetera. And, you know, I went to college and I drank and people have experimented with drugs. And so it's not the end of the world. With him, it was a very serious problem. And when we finally came to grips with it, which is difficult, we had an intervention because nobody will ever admit that they have this disease for reasons I will go into later. We sent him to one of those fancy Malibu rehabilitation mm-hmm. places for 30 days. And on the 31st day, he got loaded again.
Jeez.
Sent him back, this time for 60 days. And that took for about 2 months. And then finally, we said, you know, we have to really get to something serious. And we sent him to a sober living facility in Virginia.
Did he fight you?
Oh, tooth and nail.
Yeah.
Tooth, and they all do. And yeah. I'll tell you why. But let me finish the story, and then we'll get to how people react when you confront them with something you know they have. And they will not acknowledge it. And came back from Virginia after 9 months, enrolled at USC, was on the dean's list for 3 years, ready to graduate, go to law school. And he met a woman who I don't think was a very good influence on him. They went to a party, and he had always said, I'm a drug addict, I will never use drugs. But prove to me I can't have a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
No way you can do it except to say that's what the evidence
sure.
is. And so he had two Jägermeisters at a very, very modest, from what I understand, party at the Elks Club, not a crazy rave type thing.
Right.
And his then fiance suggested that they split an ecstasy.
Which is a tranquil, it's a horse pill, isn't it?
You know, I don't think it's a horse pill. It's supposedly a sexual drug, but it has different effects on different people. And again, with street drugs, you never know the purity or what you're really
you
getting.
You don't know what you're ingesting.
And he got sick. Whether the drug was bad, whether it was because he hadn't been drinking in years and now... had this reaction.
Vomiting, passed out, all that?
He started to vomit, projectile vomit, obviously was very weak. And so his friends thought, well, you know, if we call the paramedics, the folks will find out, the engagement will be off, he'll be back in rehab.
Yeah.
Let him sleep it off and he'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then at 7 in the morning, we got a call that no parent ever wants to get. Brent's blue, and he's not breathing. And I knew when we got to the hospital before he did that the news would not be good. 5 to 6 minutes is the window you have from the time you stop
That's
getting
right.
oxygen. And when he came in, he was in a coma. They tested him overnight and found that it was irreversible, that he had brain damage and would never be anything but in a vegetative state. And we had to make a decision that parents never want to make, and that is that we had to let them go. And so we thought, what are we going to do And a friend of mine came to me. And it actually was Roger King's brother, Michael King, who we just lost last year, unfortunately, to a bout with pneumonia. And he said, I want to make a substantial donation to your favorite charity in honor of your son.
Hold that story right there, Bob. We're going to come back in a moment. Robert Shapiro with us. We are talking about the Brent Shapiro Foundation. We'll tell you a little bit later on how you can get involved, too. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Shapiro with me, and we will take calls next hour, by the way, and I would like your stories, too. Robert, you were just talking about, I believe, how the foundation might have been formed.
Yeah, so Michael King said, I want to donate in your son's memory to your favorite charity. And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, you know, Michael, I'm going to start a foundation for alcohol and drug awareness. And he wrote a very substantial check, which was seed money. And 3 months later, we started the Brent Shapiro Foundation for Alcohol and Drug Awareness. And at that time, our mission was just what it said, awareness.
Yeah.
Let people know that this is a disease, that it's not a shameful disease, and that it affects a lot of people, and nobody's talking about it. And going back 10 years, it's not like today. Today, everybody realizes that we have an epidemic of enormous proportions in this country. It's on every news show. People talk about it. It's open. There's still a stigma that people don't want to talk about their own personal stories, but they'll talk about other people's mm-hmm. stories. Mm-hmm. And they're not just giving lip service to, well, yeah, it's a disease. But if you really didn't want it, you could get rid of it. Not that easy. Now, today, people really realize, number one, the medical definitions have changed. And drug addiction is a recognizable mental disease in the physician's handbook.
Something's happening over the years. I don't remember giving my parents any kind of grief. I didn't drink in high school. I definitely didn't do drugs in high school. And most of my friends did not do that either, that I recall. I didn't associate myself with people and kids who did. And then later on, I noticed with my daughters, Robert, that we had some issues. You know, we had some issues of similar problems that you had with Brent. And I think as technology has evolved, something's happening to our kids today where they're more involved in this than we were and than our kids were.
George, I am in total agreement with what you said. The world today has become very close. When I was growing up, and I'm sure when you were growing up, we lived in a neighborhood. There was a television that had a few channels.
Yeah.
And the communication was really limited to a small group of people. But going forward now, everybody in the world is connected. The music, the movies are not only talking about drugs, but glorifying them. And songs are written that deal with drugs. Parties are thrown for the purpose of using drugs. It's a totally different atmosphere.
Really,
I mean, when I was growing up, I heard the word heroin. Even in law school, it related to a junkie who was a derelict on Skid Row. And now on the news, you find across the country,
it's everywhere.
People who have regular jobs, who are in the Midwest, who are on the East Coast, the West Coast, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Be aware, it's everywhere. And now heroin is a commonly used drug. It's absolutely an epidemic of enormous proportions.
You know, I didn't want to hurt myself, obviously, when I was in school, but I definitely didn't want to hurt my parents. I didn't want to let them down. My dad, and I think you were going through this program too, wanted me to be a dentist. I did 2 years of pre-dent at the University of Detroit. I always wanted to be a broadcaster since I was a kid. And I did 2 years of pre-dent for good old dad. And then afterward, I changed my major. But that's the only thing I think I can remember, Robert, that disappointed him at the time. And that was switching majors until one day he saw my name pop up on a television credit at the end of a newscast in Detroit. And he said, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yeah, Dad, I told you that's what I'm going to get into." And it changed for him. But I didn't want to let them down, Robert.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I didn't get to 2 years of pre-dent. I got to the first year and they gave me a piece of chalk and said, "Carve a tooth." And I said, "Are you kidding me?"
And that was it for you.
Yeah, I didn't have great manual dexterity. So
I love dentists, and I go there twice a year religiously, but that wasn't for me.
And I'm glad I don't have that job, standing on your feet all day, looking in somebody's throat.
Now you'd be here, I'd be saying prominent dentist, Robert Shapiro. So, and let me ask you a question about this, because you just laughed. I'm sure there are moments that you and your wife and your other son, Grant, can smile, you can laugh, you can go out. But when does that hit you again, when you're out? Because you just said, and I know this is the fact, it's always in you, the loss of Brent. When does it crop up a lot?
It crops up in very unusual ways. First of all, every holiday, every birthday, every Father's Day, every Christmas, it's obviously there more. His memorial, it obviously is a big deal. To this day, 30 or 40 of his friends come to the ceremony with us, to the cemetery with us.
Yeah.
And we all do a ceremony where we talk about the good things he did, the funny things he did, the great kid that he was. And then we come back and we literally have a barbecue party afterwards to celebrate his life. So we try to take a positive attitude. I am very firmly committed to the idea that it takes a life to save a life. And we know now, because of Brent, we are indeed, with Brent's Club and the programs that we have now, saving lives.
Yeah, you sure are. You sure are. As a matter of fact, we support everything you do with that program. I wish we could do more as a broadcast for you, but at least we're helping to get the word out.
Yeah, and if we have a moment, I can tell you about our new program.
Yeah, because, absolutely.
Okay, so I told you we started with awareness, and now it's called the Brent Shapiro Foundation for Drug Prevention, because I think we, in part, were part of the movement that got awareness on the map. I testified before Congress. I've been on numerous television and radio shows, very, very open about our family, our history, and what took place. And that causes other people to open up and talk about it. So the awareness issue now is accomplished. We met our goal. We put out hundreds of thousands of Save a Life cards, what to do in an emergency. We published a couple of children's books that teach people how to introduce this subject. But what we're doing now, George, is revolutionary. We started a program called Brent's Club, and we're partners with the Boys and Girls Club of America.
Right.
And the Boys and Girls Club of America is a wonderful organization, but they have a problem. When the kids become teenagers, it's no longer cool to be there. We came up with this idea that if we could get parents and kids to sign a contract, that we could put together an after-school program for them at the Boys and Girls Club, not cost them anything, but allow us to test them randomly with saliva, just a swab, and DNA. And if they passed the test and stayed sober, we'd give them a reward.
Yeah.
And we'd increase those rewards.
Part of the deal, the contract.
The contract. And if they stayed sober through high school and graduated as a sober high school student, we'd give them a college scholarship. Today we have 1,000 kids in 4 different clubs, from 10 to 17. We've had almost no person fail the test. Wow. We've had one or two on one occasion, and we counsel with them, keep them in the club.
You don't belittle them or anything?
Not at all, no. And we know that if we can keep kids from using drugs before the age of 15, alcohol and drugs, while their brains are still in formation
right.
at a really young age, that the chance of a lifelong problem decreases by 500 to 800%.
That's amazing. Now, you've got another son, Grant.
Yes.
And was he older or younger than Brent?
Grant is 3 years younger than Brent.
So he obviously saw this, witnessed this, lived through it like you did and your wife. Did he ever cause a problem for you two?
No.
Totally
yeah,
different.
When I say never caused a problem, all kids cause problems.
I mean, but not
you know,
to the extent.
All kids cause problems. I mean, that's part of being a parent.
And a kid.
And a kid, you know. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do, aggravate your parents. Grant is a wonderful young man. He's a professional DJ.
Who is he?
Yeah, he started when he was 12, self-taught on scratching records and mixing. Now it's all computerized and way beyond my comprehension. But he's successful. He loves what he does, very hardworking, and he's a wonderful young man.
That's great. That is good. And he obviously... Well, I guess my question is there a biological difference in the head between the two? I mean, with any family,
you know,
one does it, another doesn't.
Here's what the experts tell me, and what I believe is drug addiction is either got a genetic element or an acquired element, and it can happen at any age to any person. I mean, right now we're seeing an epidemic of middle-aged women becoming addicted to painkillers through no fault of their own.
Right.
Through overprescription by doctors.
Overprescription, sure. Which is killing more people than most things in a hospital.
Without a question.
The website, of course, BrentShapiro.org, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Tell me about your book, The Search for Justice.
You know, I wrote that book... right after the Simpson case. And I didn't want it to be a book about the Simpson case because everybody had their own opinions and most of the world actually saw the case.
Yeah.
But it was about my experience in my life during that period of time and my family's experience.
How long was that whole ordeal, I guess?
For me, I was the first lawyer in was involved in the case for 16 months. Virtually around the clock.
That's a lot of, did you get paid for that?
I did get paid. I actually, when the trial started, had a lawyer negotiate with Simpson's lawyer because I didn't feel that it would be appropriate for me to go to a client directly.
Right.
And we disclosed how much I made during that period of time on a yearly basis.
What does a lawyer do, Robert, if you're in a case of that magnitude and you're not getting your fees?
You're in big trouble. You better go to George and borrow some money.
Yeah, really? Can you walk out? You can't, can you?
No. That's the thing with a criminal case. And very few people know that. That's very interesting that you're aware of that, George. In a criminal case, once you announce you're the attorney, you are the attorney and you cannot be removed or cannot leave for non-payment. There is a little loophole in felony cases because felony cases have two parts. Generally, there's a preliminary hearing in a state case and then a trial. And so you can do it just for the preliminary hearing only and then renegotiate with a client a fee for the trial.
And that's
what I did in this case.
A lot of people may also know and recognize you as the spokesperson for a company you started, LegalZoom.com.
Ah, that's one of my favorites. We keep the law on your side. They've gotten rid of me, though, George. They put me out and replaced me with younger and prettier people.
Oh, well.
But that's what happens. The company is one of the things I'm most proud of for a couple reasons. First, not a day goes by, and in fact, you mentioned it before we went on the air, that people don't use LegalZoom to form a business. And ordinarily, people who need to form businesses would not be able to because of the really exorbitant costs that lawyers charge and the paperwork and the real hassle. We make it easy, simple, and affordable. And so we've brought to the public legal services that they ordinarily would not have available.
Right. No, it's simple. I mean, I've used it all the time. I just put in my little credit card and get some things done, and you folks handle all the paperwork. And you're very efficient, too, that your staff is, I don't know, I've never talked to you about this, but the staff is very efficient. They get things done for you.
Well, here's the big secret of why that happens. Most people think, well, it's an internet company, and you do everything online, although we do have a very nice customer service, and it's all pretty much boilerplate. We have 1,000 full-time employees.
Wow.
That work for this company in two different states. Actually, and in three different areas in two different states, San Francisco,
that's amazing,
Glendale, and in Texas.
What did you start with? Just a handful of people?
We started with the four founders with three used computers, hoping to do 40 wills a month and break even.
Jeez. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it really is an amazing growth story, and one I'm really proud to be a part of, along with my partners, Brian Lee, Brian Liu, and Eddie Hartman.
Yeah, good people. They're good people. This weekend, the foundation is having its annual get-together where a lot of people who attend donate, and hopefully the programs you continue to develop will help other families get through the tragedy of what you went through and that they can avoid having to go through that.
That's what our mission is, and every year, we're going to try to open up more and more of these clubs around the country. My dream is to have a Brent's Club in every city that has a professional sports franchise and have the sports franchise sponsor the club. It's a win-win for everybody. It serves the community well. It keeps kids not only off drugs, but gets them into education and ties them into sports. So that's my goal. We've got four open right now, and next year I hope to open four more.
Robert, in most cases, the young child, the student, the teenager doesn't want to kill themselves at all. Do they realize the significance and the danger of doing what they're doing?
No. It's very, very interesting, and this gets to the topic of where do kids start with drugs, legalize marijuana, whether it's a gateway drug or not a gateway drug. I firmly believe it is a gateway drug. But, you know, kids are invincible. I mean, they'll jump off roofs into a 2-inch pool just to see if they could do it.
Yeah.
And with drugs, what happens is this. Try it. You're going to like it. And why do people take drugs? Makes them feel better. Plain and simple. Initially.
They escape.
Initially. You know, and so people like to feel good. But what they don't realize is that it does have devastating long-term effects. And those effects sometimes become irreversible because it causes brain damage, especially with substances like the prescription pills.
Sure.
Cocaine.
How do they get this stuff?
George, it's as easy as going to Starbucks.
Unbelievable.
There is no difficulty.
There are kids in school selling these prescription drugs.
Well, those are coming from their parents' medicine cabinets.
They steal it?
They take it right out of the cabinets.
One or two pills a day.
Absolutely.
Something like that.
Very, very simply. Or then you have the illegal drugs. You have methamphetamine, which swept the country. Then you have the people that get addicted to pills. They no longer can get them because now they are cracking down on the prescriptions and on doctors who overprescribe. And so those people that are addicted are going to heroin.
Robert, we're going to come back in a moment. We've got you for another hour. We're going to take phone calls from folks. Share your stories or questions for Robert Shapiro. Later on tonight, we're going to talk about Planet X. We've got it all for you right here on Coast to Coast AM.